Hi, everybody, and welcome to Your Health, a podcast by NPR's Science Desk, highlighting the week's top health stories. I'm Scott Hensley, manager, minder, and mentor for Shots, our health blog.
And I'm Eliza Barkley, web producer, writer, and wizard for the Science Desk. This week, Scott and I are going to talk about some cool posts we wrote.
Then we'll hear some pieces from NPR's airwaves. NPR kicked off a series on childbirth, and Melissa Block from All Things Considered sent a report from Mozambique.
We also have a piece from NPR's investigative unit, which looked into childhood deaths that used to be attributed to shaken baby syndrome. Science is showing that that diagnosis is often a mistake.
And regular contributor to Shots and NPR's airwaves, Nancy Shute, talks about the growing popularity of telemedicine.
And we'll end with an essay from a gerontologist about his favorite old-timers and why they're still around. But first, let's take a look at the blog this week. The big news in the medical world was about the drug Avastin. Scott, what is up with Avastin?
We devoted many posts to Avastin this week. It's a very popular cancer drug and a controversial one when it comes to its use for the treatment of breast cancer.
What is the controversy all about?
3 years ago, the FDA did a fast-track approval for Avastin based on one study and told the company, Genentech, get back to us with more data so we can see if this initial good result is really borne out. The studies came back. They weren't so positive. So now the FDA has been moving to revoke the approval of the drug for the treatment of breast cancer, and that precipitated a hearing that took place this past week at the FDA's headquarters in Maryland, where the company and patients made their case for keeping the breast cancer approval for Avastin intact.
So what does this mean for the women who've been taking this drug?
What the FDA has said and what the panel backed up was that the data don't support the safety and effectiveness of the drug for this use. There are some real side effects. And while the drug has helped some women for sure, overall the data don't support its use broadly. So the FDA has a little while to make a decision. If they go along with what the panel said, they will revoke it. There has been some coverage after that, though, that Medicare, for instance, and some big insurers may still pay for it. So the practical effect may not be quite as profound as some of the supporters of the drug had thought.
But there's something else going on with this in Europe, too. What are those Europeans doing with Avastin?
Yes, in fact, at the same time that the FDA panel was looking to scale back the approval, the European authorities expanded Avastin's approval to include a combination with a drug called Xeloda for treatment of breast cancer. So they looked at pretty much the same data, and they came to a different conclusion.
Is Avastin used for anything else?
Yes, it's one of the biggest selling cancer drugs in the world, and it is a mainstay of treatment for colorectal cancer. That is not under any dispute. The drug will continue to be available. It's really the specifics of whether the drug makes sense for advanced breast cancer or not. Now, Eliza, we had a post that I found fascinating that you wrote about a project to find new types of houses that could help prevent tuberculosis.
This is a really interesting little project. It's a group called Archive, and it's headed by an architect. And he thought, hey, maybe we can actually prevent tuberculosis transmission by designing new homes for people that keep that airborne pathogen from getting stuck inside someone's home and jumping from one person to another. So he solicited designs from people all over the world. He got a lot of cool entries, narrowed it down, and they have now 5 prototype homes which they're planning to build in Haiti, and the best one, maybe they'll build a lot of them.
What do the houses look like?
Well, they're pretty neat, and the main feature that is so special about them is ventilation. They've got great ventilation systems, so this natural air is flowing through the house consistently so that no bacteria can get stuck in there. That's the idea.
Are they expensive?
Well, $50,000 was the limit for all the people who entered this contest. That is still a lot of money in Haiti. $50,000 house here, cheap. It's actually out of reach for pretty much all Haitians. So they're going to have to find a way, if this project is really going to work, to bring that price way, way down.
Check out the post because there's a picture of one of the houses and it looks pretty cool.
Scott, are you planning to go to the beach this summer?
I would love to. And thanks to Shots, I think I'm getting a better idea about which beaches to go to and which ones to skip. Eliza, you helped on this post. Maybe you can illuminate this important summer topic for our audience.
Well, the environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, put out their annual report on the nation's beaches this week. And, of course, there are some good news and there are some bad news, just like all these reports that rate something as desirable as a beach.
All right. I want to know, which beaches should I be thinking about going to? Any that would help me out?
Well, you and I are very lucky because some of the cleanest beaches in the country, turns out, are just down the road in Delaware, not so far away from D.C.
How did they figure out which beaches were good and which beaches were bad?
Great question. In fact, these beaches were monitored using samples. So they went and took water samples, and they're checking out the bacteria content.
Ew.
In the water. How does bacteria get there? This is stuff that washes down from urban areas typically. And also, the beaches that scored well were very good at informing people when there was a health risk. So they put out advisories, they closed the beaches down, they let people know.
I have to ask, what were some of the bad beaches?
Well, the Great Lakes region in general didn't do so well, and there were several beaches in Southern California, L.A., and Orange County that also, turns out, did not do a good job either of telling people when the beach was dirty or cleaning it up.
For people who want to see the full list, go to Shots, and we have a link to the whole report and also a summary of some of the top beaches, the superstars, as NRDC called them, I think, and then the not-so-super.
All right. We also had a post on a report on kids in the media. Is there anything that we don't already know? I mean,
do I detect some boredom on your part?
Kids and television. They shouldn't watch much. But is there anything else we need to know about this?
It is true. We have written often about the recommendations that children's media habits should be controlled. Any parent will tell you how difficult that is to do, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't try. This week, the leading group of pediatricians issued a policy statement in the journal Pediatrics with some more specifics.
What are some of the specifics?
For kids 2 and under, they shouldn't be watching any TV at all. Kids older than 2, limit it to 2 hours a day. Then they also had a recommendation for doctors, and this was new to me. They said each pediatrician should be asking at well kid visits, do you have a TV in your bedroom? Do you have a device connected to the internet in your bedroom? And that should help steer the conversation, guide the conversation with parents and with the kids about limiting screen time.
I foresee some awkward conversations between doctors and parents about televisions down the line.
Absolutely, but they make the case pretty persuasively that the obesity epidemic in this country with kids has a lot to do with inactivity that is related to tube time. There was one last recommendation that I should note,
okay.
And that was that the doctors were urged to get vocal in public policy and to argue in favor of restrictions on advertising of junk food and things like that to kids.
Well, we'll see what comes of that, won't we? Thank you, Scott. He's going to stay on with us to talk about some of our other pieces this week.
There's a report from a new NPR series, Beginnings, Stories of Women and Childbirth. Misoprostol is a drug that health experts say is saving women's lives around the world. But it's also controversial. It can prevent bleeding after childbirth, but it's also used to induce abortion. NPR's Melissa Block went to Mozambique to learn how they're grappling with the dilemma.
A group of 4 traditional birth attendants welcomes Mozambican Dr. Cassimo Beek back to their community in rural Nampula province in northern Mozambique.
Obrigado.
These women were part of a year-long trial of misoprostol in rural communities. The trial was designed and carried out by an American women's health nonprofit called Venture Strategies Innovations. It was led by Dr. Beek. Dr. Beek is an OBGYN, has practiced medicine for decades in Mozambique, and he knows well how deadly childbirth can be in his country. In Mozambique, a woman has a 1 in 37 lifetime risk of maternal death. By comparison, in the U.S., that number's about 1 in 2,000. And in Mozambique, Dr. Beek says, most of those deaths will be from postpartum hemorrhage.
They can die in 2 hours.
The traditional birth attendants have their own way of measuring the effectiveness of misoprostol. Their gauge is the brightly colored cloth called the capulana, which is worn as a skirt or a shawl or as a sling to carry a baby. And it's useful in childbirth, too. Atia Dwau explains that before misoprostol, they would need 3 or 4 capulanas to soak up typical blood loss from the mother. After miso, just 1. Have all of you watched women die because they were bleeding after giving birth before miso was available? The traditional birth attendants nod and talk of cases they remember well. Julieta Gracinda Carize describes a woman bleeding like water running from a faucet. She says she sent the family to look for a car to take the woman to the hospital, but it was too late. She died.
I can say in one word, simple word, this misoprostol is something... A miraculous drug.
A miraculous drug, says Dr. Beek. For one, it's cheap. And unlike oxytocin, which is given as a shot and requires refrigeration, misoprostol is taken in pill form, a real benefit in rural areas without electricity. There are risks, though. If it's taken to induce labor in too high a dose, misoprostol can cause uterine rupture, which can be fatal to mother and child. But for Dr. Beek and other advocates of misoprostol, the widespread benefits far outweigh those risks. They want the Mozambican government to train traditional birth attendants on how to use misoprostol and to scale up supply for the whole country. Their case is bolstered by a recent decision from the World Health Organization. WHO added misoprostol to its core list of essential medicines for preventing postpartum hemorrhage. That decision came after a lot of impassioned debate.
A tablet seems like a really good idea as a quick fix.
But WHO pharmacologist Suzanne Hill still has reservations about misoprostol.
It's on the list, and if I was giving birth in the middle of nowhere with nothing else and this was available, would I use it personally? Yes, no question. But do I think it's an essential medicine? As a WHO defines an essential medicine, well, I actually think oxytocin's the real essential medicine here.
Oxytocin is more effective, Hill says, and she worries that seeing misoprostol as a panacea might obscure the real long-term need.
We know that the real fix to the problem involves fixing the system so that women can get to the facility, can get care, can give birth in a controlled environment, and that's much harder to fix than handing out a tablet and hoping.
For others, the real problem with misoprostol is that it can be used to induce abortion and that it makes abortion too easy. Anti-abortion groups also cite studies showing that if the drug doesn't work and the pregnancy goes to term, there's an increased risk of birth defects. At the Maputo Central Hospital in the Mozambican capital, I sat in on a session for a dozen young women who recently had abortions, a group meeting to teach them about contraception, maybe for the first time. Many of them are high schoolers, and they told a similar story. When they got pregnant, their friends or mothers told them about the pills that would induce abortion. They bought misoprostol from a pharmacy and took the pills at home. Then they went to the hospital, where a nurse performed vacuum aspiration to complete the abortion. Now, technically, abortion is still illegal in Mozambique. That's on the books. But in practice, it's extremely common, with abortions performed all the time at government-run hospitals. Misoprostol is readily available at drugstores, over-the-counter.
It's not prescribed. Anyone can go to the pharmacy to buy it. It's not prescribed.
Ida Libombu is an advisor to Mozambique's Minister of Health and an OBGYN. In her view, misoprostol has made abortions much safer. She remembers the horrific botched abortions she dealt with as a young doctor in the 1980s, when unsafe abortion was one of the leading causes of maternal death.
What they have seen At the beginning of my training, my internship, it was terrible.
What did you see?
I saw like intestines coming out from the vagina.
The intestines?
Yes. They use this kind of instruments that were perforating the uterus and giving a lot of complications. And women die. But now with omeprazole, the maternal death due to abortion has reduced.
Dr. Lubombu is among those in Mozambique's Ministry of Health promoting a rollout of misoprostol around the country to prevent postpartum hemorrhage. And the traditional birth attendants we met up in the north of the country? At the end of our visit, they sent us out this way with a song thanking Dr. Kasimo Beek for training them and asking him to bring them more misoprostol.
Babies who die in situations where child abuse is suspected are often diagnosed as victims of shaken baby syndrome. But experts disagree about whether this diagnosis is used too freely. It might even have landed innocent people in prison. NPR's Joseph Shapiro met the doctor who came up with the diagnosis. They talked about some of his concerns about how it's being used now.
Dr. Norman Guthkelch gets credited with first connecting head injuries in young children to violent shaking. It's now called shaken baby syndrome. He's 95, a retired pediatric neurosurgeon, and he's speaking out for the first time about the syndrome and the legal system.
If you get the diagnosis of fatal shaken baby syndrome wrong, potentially someone's life will be terminated.
Recently, a defense attorney asked Guthkelch to look at the records of an Arizona man who's been in prison for 10 years, convicted of killing his baby boy. Guthkelch was horrified by what he read.
I think I used the expression in my report, I wouldn't hang a cat on the evidence of shaking as presented.
A medical examiner's autopsy report said the child died of shaken baby syndrome, but discounted other possible causes, like the fact that the five-month-old had severe seizures and other medical problems. Guthkelch worries that there are too many cases like this one.
You may, in your heart, believe that this is a case of shaking, but you've got to prove it just as carefully as any other case.
NPR's investigative unit worked with PBS Frontline and ProPublica. We studied nearly 24 cases in the U.S. and Canada, some involving shaking, where people were first convicted but later acquitted or the charges dropped. Guthkelch says it's important to educate parents about the dangers of shaking children violently. A baby's brain is soft and easily damaged. Today, the retired surgeon lives with his wife in a house on a peak in Tucson. He's tall and gets around with a cane. He reads from his groundbreaking paper, published 40 years ago this spring in the British Medical Journal.
It's quite short, the paper. Infantile subdural hematoma and its relationship to whiplash injuries.
That research was the first to explain a perplexing brain injury. Sometimes babies and other young children were brought to the hospital with bleeding on the surface of the brain. But there was no sign of the cause, no broken bones, bruises, or other signs of physical abuse. Guthkelch solved the mystery with a simple observation. Where he lived in northern England, parents sometimes punished their children by shaking them. It was socially acceptable.
They had no motive to lie, so the parents told me the truth. Yes, I shook him.
Other scientists built on his research. Now, shaken baby syndrome is diagnosed when doctors find that unexplained bleeding on the brain and two other symptoms, bleeding behind the retinas and brain swelling. What Guthkelch worries about is that too many medical experts see that triad of symptoms and conclude a child's been shaken without considering other possibilities. But not all experts share his desire for new caution in diagnosing shaken baby syndrome.
I truly believe deaths are not being prosecuted anymore because of this.
Terry Covington says there's already too much caution, and that because of disputes over the science, there are growing numbers of cases where the abuser isn't punished at all. Covington runs the National Center for Child Death Review. It's a research center that helps states investigate child deaths.
I have heard many a discussion of reluctance from both law enforcement and prosecutors to even start moving these cases forward in the way that they would have done 5-10 years ago.
That's one reason Dr. Guthkelch says it's time to get all sides together and try to agree on what can be said with scientific certainty about shaken baby syndrome. It's a difficult conversation.
But I do think that good will come of what politicians, I think, call free and frank discussions when they mean that they're going to half-kill one another across the bargaining table.
He'd like to help lead that conversation, but he's 95 years old, so he wants it to happen soon. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
If you don't live in a major city, it can be hard to find medical specialists. Telemedicine might be the answer. As video chatting gets better resolution and more popular, it's a more workable solution. But NPR's Nancy Shute reports that insurance companies aren't yet on board.
Deanna Ventura was seeing a neurologist for her Parkinson's, but she was still having trouble walking, bathing, and doing her housework.
I knew that I needed more than what he was doing for me.
Managing Parkinson's symptoms is a tricky business, and the drugs used can have serious side effects. You need a specialist. But for Ventura, the closest was 2 hours away from her home in upstate New York, and she doesn't drive. So the specialist comes to her.
So I last saw you in February, and how have you been doing since February?
If it sounds like Ray Dorsey is far away, that's because he is, 343 miles away at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore. He's a movement disorder specialist, and he's been Ventura's doctor for the last 4 years.
How about your Parkinson's disease? Any complaints related to your Parkinson's?
I find that I drop things a lot more. I'm finding that my balance is worse, which wasn't good anyways.
Ventura is 68 years old, a cheerful grandmother with white hair. She's sitting in the conference room of a nursing home just down the street from her apartment in New Hartford, New York. She sees the doctor on a flat-screen TV. He can see her on his laptop. It's healthcare by video call.
Do you know what today's date is?
Yes, today is May 20th, and the year is 2011.
And who's the Secretary of State?
Hillary Clinton.
Pretty good.
People with Parkinson's can have trouble with memory and speech. They often have tremors and stiff movements. So Dorsey needs to test Ms. Ventura's motor skills.
Can I see you put your hands out like this?
He sticks his hands straight out and holds them steady. Ventura tries it.
So you have a little bit of shaking in your right hand.
Yes.
By observing that tremor in each visit, Dorsey can get a good sense of the disease's progression. He checks on her medications, too.
So you look good as usual, Ms. Ventura.
Thank you.
The one thing I want you to work on is exercise. How are we doing on that front?
He can see his patient's guilty smile.
My hesitation tells you.
Studies of telemedicine have found that the care patients receive is at least as good as in-office visits. Patients also say it's much more convenient, and it's often cheaper. Ventura thinks she knows why.
Believe me when I tell you, he doesn't miss a thing, because I never noticed that my lower chin was quivering.
But Dr. Dorsey, from 300 miles away, did notice, and he adjusted her medication to control the tremor. Ventura says her symptoms have improved to the point where she can now use a cane instead of a walker. And she's not the only patient who's happy. Tony Joseph is the administrator of the Presbyterian Home, which hosts the video visits.
The Parkinson's people said, Tony, this is better than when I used to go to the doctor's office because I'm spending actually more time with that neurologist.
But there is one big problem with specialty care via telemedicine. In most cases, insurance won't pay for it.
Right now, if I were to try to bill a Blue Cross Blue Shield or anybody else for a neurological consult like we're doing right now, they're not going to cover it.
So Tony Joseph has taken to running fundraisers to pay Dr. Dorsey and the other neurologist who provides Parkinson's care. That costs about $40,000 a year.
We do a Parkinson's awareness walk, and we've been very successful with that.
Those fundraisers have kept the New Hartford program going for 4 years. But why won't insurers pay for telemedicine? Dr. Jay Sanders helped pioneer remote health care in the 1990s.
Traditionally, payment has always been made based upon the physical presence of the doctor with the patient.
That's to protect against insurance fraud. And there's yet another stumbling block. Doctors have to be licensed to practice in the state their patients live. Ray Dorsey knows that even if telemedicine overcame those barriers, it wouldn't cure all ills. That becomes clear during the video call when Deanna Ventura reaches up to rub her neck.
It is restricting. I could feel it. And I haven't had this. This is something new for me.
This is one of the limitations of telemedicine is I can't fully assess your neck.
He doesn't think it's anything serious, but he wants someone to actually feel that neck. So he asked her to get it checked out by her family doctor.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dorsey. You take care of yourself and your family.
And we'll see you in August. Sandy will give you a time.
Making for a good visit, even from far away. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
And lastly, we have a piece from commentator Mark Lax, a gerontologist, who talks about some really interesting research about how, for some old people, their chance of dying and getting sick actually decreases the older they get.
I have a 98-year-old patient who's not only independent, but rather quite dashing. And he recently asked me a series of questions that reminded me of one of the most intriguing scientific papers in all of gerontology. Is it okay if he has a little cheese and butter from time to time? In modest amounts, he assured me. Is an occasional glass of wine okay? And, here's the kicker, is it still safe for him to make his annual solo pilgrimage to Switzerland, where he enjoys fresh air and a good hike? The answers? Yes, yes, and yes. Now look, advancing age is a risk factor for a variety of medical conditions, as well as shoving off this mortal coil. But what if I told you there's kind of an escape velocity, an age at which the risk of death and disability actually begins to fall? In a stunning paper a decade ago, James Vaupell of the Max Planck Institute looked at the evidence for this hypothesis in lower and higher organisms, yeast, fruit flies, worms, and yes, humans, and he came to this startling conclusion. At the extremes of age in all these species, rates of death actually drop. And here's the cherry on top finale of that paper. Vaupell decided to see if the data pattern is limited only to living things. So he looked at death rates for, are you ready for this? Automobiles. Here, death, quote unquote, was defined as when a car's owner stops registering it. And indeed, the same escape velocity pattern was seen with old clunkers. A subset of motor vehicles are simply unstoppable. The old Chevy or Honda that keeps going and going and going. Sure, it needs a few replacement parts over its long life, and it certainly gets dinged and dented. But after passing some astronomical odometer reading, the damn thing seems to be nearly indestructible. We've all had certain inspirational people in our lives who behave the same way. Stated differently, things and people in motion tend to stay in motion, and those that don't stop, or worse. And the older you get, the older you are likely going to get. So I'd argue that my 98-year-old patient's wish to take his annual stroll in the Alps is probably not only safe, but actually therapeutic. I'm not a Pollyanna, we all have to go sometime. But like many of my patients, he seems to have achieved escape velocity. And there's no reason for him to stop now. Maybe the comedian George Burns, when asked about the secret to his longevity, had it right, but for the wrong reason. The key, he said, is to make it to 100, because very rarely do you read about people dying after that age.
That's all for the podcast this week. For more, see npr.org/shots, our health blog. I'm Scott Hensley.
And I'm Eliza Barkley. Happy 4th of July weekend.